Terry McGowan had been a beat cop, a Marine captain, and a special agent for the FBI before retiring at the age of 50. But when tragedy struck the United States on September 11th, 2001, Terry felt a sense of duty to protect and serve his country. McGowan became a special advisor to the Marines and was immediately put to use on the front line of battle in Afghanistan. He later celebrated his 59th birthday dodging bullets at a Marine base nicknamed the Alamo. In his new memoir, The Silence of War, An Old Marine and a Young Marine's War, Terry McGowan details his return to combat 3 decades after leaving the Corps. It's a great pleasure to welcome Terry McGowan to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Very nice to have you on the program. Thank you for being with us.
Very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
At what point did you think, after coming back, of wanting to write and tell this story and realize that you did indeed have something to say?
That's a very, very good question. It dovetails right back to the title, The Silence of War. See, most guys, when they're in war, they don't talk about it. I don't care what war it is. They don't talk about it. They don't talk about it to their families. They don't talk about it to their friends. They might talk about it with each other, but they don't talk about it anywhere else. The words just don't come. The book, I tell you in real time what I saw, what I thought, what I felt. So it kind of breaks that silence. And insofar as I might be typical, and I use the word in quotation marks, insofar as I might be typical of everybody else, then it breaks the silence of war, because what I felt, they felt.
So give us a sense of how you reentered the picture here, because of your age, you were not allowed to technically reenlist. So what were you allowed to do?
I was hired by a company comprised of former West Point officers. They held the belief that experienced police officers or agents who had been involved in complex investigations had something to offer the military that the military itself did not have. I found that to be true. So I was hired by them. The fact that I was a former Marine officer was just icing on the cake. What they really wanted was an experienced law enforcement investigator. And they were sprinkled throughout Army and Marine battalions in Iraq and Afghanistan, later in Afghanistan. We were the first battalion of Marines to go back to Afghanistan since the initial invasion. So I was hired by those guys. I volunteered to go with the Marines. They said, sure. And then I was supposed to go to Iraq, and when I heard there was a Marine battalion going to Afghanistan, I said I'd volunteer for them. And that's how I ended up with 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines in Afghanistan.
So how much of you're with these guys, and how was your duty, your duties assigned versus what they were doing?
Well, it was a wonderful thing to be half a civilian, half a Marine, because, for example, when the other guys had to sit through their 999th IED awareness lecture, where they went over the same thing again, I just got up and walked out. Nobody could say anything about that. That was good. As far as what my duties were, since we were the first ones into Afghanistan, my duties were extremely nebulous. I had to create my own duty. I was lucky enough to have a terrific working relationship with my battalion commander. He's then Lieutenant Colonel Richard Hall, now Colonel Hall. We just had a terrific relationship, and he basically let me find my own way. He had the confidence in me that I was going to find a way to be value added, and he didn't keep me on a short leash. And so every day I was thinking, how can I best help the mission? How can I best help these guys? And that kind of evolved over time. It kind of changed.
These guys are very, very young men, 18, 19,
yes,
20 years old. So what is it like to, in some ways, be a father figure and to really have them in your charge?
Well, in some ways, I really was a father figure. There were guys who took me aside and had an earshot and told me things they said at the end, I've never told anybody this. So they were looking for a father's ear, and they got it. In other respects, my nickname was Old Man. That was it. I mean, before I got to the platoon I ended up with, the grandpa was 27 years old. His nickname was Grandpa. He was 27. He was the old guy.
Blew him out of the water, didn't you?
Yeah, blew him right out of the water, yeah. His nickname stayed Grandpa, but I was old man. The guys accepted me, most of the guys accepted me as a Marine, albeit an old Marine. My brother calls me a mutant, you know, because I'm able to do things at my age that people my age aren't supposed to do. And so I was able to do physically the job that I was doing. I didn't have to go where I went. I could have stayed at battalion headquarters and pushed pencils around or whatever, or just used my brain and slept in air-conditioned tents and ate Greek chow, but I just didn't want to. The battalion commander came up to me one day. Like I said, we had a great working relationship, and he said, "I'm losing sleep over Gulistan. All the intel indicates that the Taliban are massing to overwhelm them. They want to annihilate them." And I said, "Well, why don't you send me up there and let me see what I can pick up on my FBI radar?" And he looked at me funny. He said, "Don't get yourself killed." And I went up there, and things were worse than I thought. And so I couldn't leave. Who wants to be the last man out of the Alamo? As you say, they're 19 to 21 year old Marines. In my eyes, they're kids. I didn't sign on to see kids get slaughtered. I could never look myself in the mirror again, so it's like it would have been easier to die. But they weren't just kids. They were Marines. You know, they fight like Marines. And the enemy found that out, and they found that out early on, and we drove them clean out of reach. They quit tackling when I was after maybe, a month. After a month of fighting, they pretty much just pulled out. Hope that answers your question.
It does. How much was 9/11 and what had happened on the mind, on your mind, and on the mind of the young men who were in that battalion with you?
I don't think 9/11 was on their minds at all at that time. They had the battalion, half the battalion had already deployed to Iraq. They'd already been in combat. They already had their combat experience. They already had their wounds. They already had their dead. They were already combat veterans. The other half were green guys who were, you know, just looking to live up to the others. In that kind of a situation, it reminds me of a passage in the book William Manchester wrote called "Goodbye Darkness." He was in the Marines in World War II. He started with Guadalcanal and went all the way through to the last battle in Okinawa. Here he is in Okinawa, and he's got that million-dollar wound, the wound that's going to get him sent home. And he writes in the book how much he wanted the war to end so he could go home. And yet he absconded from the hospital and went back to his squad. That's the squad is everything. The squad is your family. The squad is closer to you than your mother. The squad is everything. So guys don't fight for 9/11. They don't fight for mom and apple pie. They don't fight for the flag. They fight for their squad. And Manchester first laid it out in print. And I saw it in action over there. You know, guys that were pulled off the line because they were wounded, dying to get back. And chafing until they did. And some of them weren't allowed to come back. And they were just screaming bloody murder. They wanted to come back. It's I don't know if it's uniquely Marine or uniquely combat guys, but it certainly was the case in the Marines.
When just the title, "An Old Marine and a Young Marine's War," how had things changed? I mean, that had to have gone through your mind.
Oh, things changed tremendously. First of all, the Marine Corps, as I experienced it, I was in the old, every generation prior is called the old Corps.
Sure.
You know, I was in the old Corps. We got hand-me-downs from the Army issued to us. You know, we didn't have any equipment or anything. We were doing everything with nothing forever, that kind of thing. And we were training to fight the Soviet Union. So we were training for World War III. And now the guys are fighting small unit. I mean, hey, our major unit was a platoon. That's three squads. You know, when I was training, it was three platoons as part of a composite company, which was part of a composite, you know, regiment, which was part of a division, at least on paper. For us in the tall grass and the mud, it didn't matter. We could see the guy on our right and the guy on our left. That was it. But you know, theoretically, we were training to move as a division attacking the Soviet Union. That's all changed. Now, the Marine Corps has probably never been so well-equipped in its entire existence. These guys, they issued me more gear than my whole platoon got back when I was on active duty. I even said that. And I said, I hope you're going to issue me a Lance Corporal to carry all this stuff. I had to drag it to my car. Half of it never left the States. Half of it I left locked in my car. Of the half I brought with me, a quarter of that stayed in the rear with the gear. I wasn't, you know, I learned as an active duty Marine, if I can't eat it, drink it, or shoot it, I'm not carrying it. It's too doggone heavy, yeah. Particularly in that heat. They had ceramic bullet stopping plates. I took them out. They were just too heavy. They were too heavy. I believe in moving fast and moving light and not being exhausted by all the weight you got to carry. The one thing I couldn't get enough of was water and ammunition. They were issued seven magazines. I carried between 11 and 13. And, of course, we all carried as much water as we possibly could. So things have changed in that regard.
When it comes to those things that you left in the car, left in the States, how would you present it to the young Marines? Would they look at you and say, well, you don't have this, and then think, well, maybe you should, or let them dismiss it as well?
First of all, they had their orders to obey.
Yes.
I didn't have to. I was pretty much my own guy, right? Second of all, they all knew that I'd been a captain. Well, you know, a captain outranks a second lieutenant, and a second lieutenant, even though he was in command and I worked for him, nobody was going to question my decision. The one thing, the lieutenant never knew I took the bullet stopping plates out. I'm sure he didn't, or he would have told me to put it back in. One day, after the first night attack, we knew the Taliban had to be in town. They had to be hiding out. Lieutenant was very audacious. I loved the guy. He just took everybody he could, and we marched right down the center of town, and we were looking for a fight. And we were insulting the Taliban. We were calling them out. I wasn't even wearing a helmet in the old days. It's called Kevlar now, out of the material it's made out of. I wasn't even wearing it. I was wearing my soft cover, my Marine, typical Marine 8-point cap. And anyway, the Taliban didn't take the bait. And on the way back to the lieutenant, who was just an extraordinary gentleman, he says, Terry, would you do me a favor? The next time we go out to make contact with the enemy, would you wear your Kevlar? So after that, I just felt, you know, I've got to do it. He's the boss. I've got to do it. Even a request is an order, so I have to do it. But so I wore my helmet after that. But if it was up to me, I wouldn't have. I just worn the soft cover.
What do you feel you personally accomplished in that time returning?
I was able to get to the bottom of things that wouldn't have gotten, nobody would have known. For example, an IED went off and killed a bus driver and several civilians. The lieutenant went down to the sub-governor's compound and asked him what he knew about it, and he lied and denied for a good half hour, and the chief of police was there with him. And I sat there, and I'm looking at these two guys, and I'm thinking, they're lying. I didn't say a word. And when the lieutenant got up to go and everybody stood up to put their gear on and all that, you could see there was a visible sign of relief across the two Afghans' faces. So at that moment, I said, hey, I just want to know one thing. And everybody stopped and looked at me. And I said, why didn't you tell the bus driver about that IED? And before he could stop himself, the one guy just blurted out, well, I told him. And he goes, well, I was conducting an investigation. And the lieutenant went absolutely ballistic because they've been lying and denying to him. They've been denying any knowledge of it whatsoever for half an hour. So that kind of thing. There was three guys who were allegedly kidnapped by the Taliban one at a time over a three-day period. And I was talking to one of them, and imagine trying to conduct an interrogation through an interpreter. It's not easy. And it dawned on me, these guys weren't kidnapped. The Taliban, they carry their – first of all, it takes a tremendous amount of ammunition to conduct an attack. That's something I know from my experience as an officer. Logistically, you don't get that in the movies. You know, if you run out of bullets, it's over. It's just done. It's finished. So, and there's a lot of bullets being shot. That means there's a lot of bullets moving forward. You got to have a lot of ammunition. And so the Taliban came over the mountains on foot on these little donkey trails, and they're carrying their ammunition on donkeys and on trails, and they get to the foot of the mountains, and they've got to cross this great desert plain to get to their staging area. Well, how did they do that? If they tried to do it by donkey and on foot, one of our mobile patrols would have run into them, caught them out in the open, and slaughtered them. Hmm. What they did is these three guys volunteered to go out and help them, and they used their vehicles to carry the ammunition. I put that together, and I hammered the one guy through an interpreter, and his body English, my God, his body English. The lieutenant stood there, and he was shaking his head going, my God, I never would have guessed. You know, these guys weren't kidnapped. They were volunteers. You know, things like that. Also, myself and another guy who was an MP. In fact, you're from Albany, right?
Yes.
Well, this guy is now retired from the village of Leroy, out near Rochester. He was with the 42nd MP Company out of New York, and he was called to active duty. And his name is Kyle Slocum. And he and I together mapped out the entire human terrain of that entire valley. We worked with one of the Afghans, and we put every village on the map, and we color-coded them by their tribal affiliations and their sub-tribal affiliations and their whether they were Sunni or Shiite, whatever. And we just did that because that's what cops do. When we handed that in to the intelligence section, when you know at the end of it all, they were ecstatic. This is what they wanted, but they didn't know how to do that kind of stuff. Military doesn't know how to do that, but that's typical investigative police work. You know, whether you're a lieutenant in a small village in upstate New York or whether you're an FBI agent, you put your heads together and you can do this. So those are the kinds of things that I brought to the table.
Name of the book is The Silence of War, an old Marine and a Young Marine's War by Terry McGowan. The book is published by Berkeley Caliber. Terry, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.